You're listening to Panel Borders, Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, continuing our month of episodes about British comics, I'm talking to cartoonist Tom Gould about his work. From his small press comics, to his strips in magazines and newspapers, such as Move to the City and Hunter and Painter, to his latest graphic novel, Goliath. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of checks, radio, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, country, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Tom Gould, and we're in his studio in East London. And looking at the objects around me, you've turned this into a very homely space. You've got a massive collection of graphic novels and illustrated books, but also boxes of your own work that's about to be shipped off. So presumably this is not only the place where you work, but it's actually the HQ of Buenaventura Press.
Well, no. Buenaventura Press is Alvin Buenaventura, who's in California. But this is where I, when I self-publish things, this is where I distribute from and prepare things from, and I do buy stock from them to distribute. Yes, this is where it all happens.
Does that make it hard in a way that not only are you creating work here, but you're also having to think about packaging it and sending it off in the same space?
Not really. I mean, the things I like about self-publishing is sort of the control I have over it and how quick it is to sort of put a comic together and publish it. But the stuff I don't like is actually distribution and all the kind of financial sides of it. So that's what's been quite nice about doing my new book, Withdrawn and Quarterly, is not being involved in that and just concentrating on the fun bits. Mm.
And the new book, Goliath, it's done in quite a traditional graphic novel format, as opposed to, say, your other work, which varies massively in terms of size and shape. Something like Hunter and Painter, for example, is an extreme landscape format, mimicking its original publication as a strip. You do your mini comics that are absolutely minute and come in little envelopes. And then something like... brain's gone. The Gigantic Robot is an oversized picture book.
Yeah.
That sort of playfulness of people who are fans of your work not knowing what kind of shape or size the next project is going to be. Do you like that? Because it doesn't tie you down to a specific format or way of working.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely interested in that. I'm interested in design and making interesting objects. And that's something that interests me, but it's also been a downside in some ways. A lot of those books aren't very shop friendly, and for that reason, with Goliath, I did stick to, I suppose, a more traditional scale and size, because I wanted it to maybe just get to a few more people than the people who were willing to search out the strange bookshops who would previously have taken my work.
Well, actually, I popped into Dave's Comics in Brighton yesterday and I asked them what they had by you. I already had Goliath and the Gigantic Robot. And they pointed me in the direction of an illustrated copy of The Iron Man by Ted Hughes, which I didn't know you'd illustrated. And actually, I was surprised to find that in a comic shop. And then conversely, driving here, I drove past Book Art Bookshop, where I guess that would be a place where a person could go to find your less traditionally published works.
Yes, well, I suppose the stuff previously to Goliath is I suppose straddles those two things of comic shops and the other thing I'm interested in of artist books.
Although presumably you can make a living as an illustrator, otherwise you'd have another job on the side, which suggests that getting commissions from magazines, doing work with Drawn and Quarterly, means that you can work in different venues simultaneously, whether it's self-publishing or a more mainstream publisher, and do it in such a way that you can make a living.
Yeah, I mean, I mainly make my living doing illustrations for book covers, magazines, and the weekly things I do for The Guardian and The New York Times. And then the comics up until now has been more something I do for fun. I try, when I self-publish things, I try and make some money doing them, but that's not the primary aim with them. But I suppose with something like Goliath, which is fits into a more traditional niche in the market, I hope that through doing things like that, I can have a slightly more commercial aspect to my comics work, make a bit more money doing it, and spend a little bit less time doing illustration.
When you were studying at art school, did they give you advice as whether you could break into the illustration industry? Did they say, you know, comics are something you'll never make a living at? I mean, or did they actually say, no, just do what you want to do and, you know, get recognised for your talent?
Yeah, both the art schools I went to, I studied at Edinburgh College of Art and then the Royal College of Art. And nobody was very interested in money.
Okay.
Or the tutors or advice on careers in many ways. They did just want you to do interesting things. And I think some people I've spoken to, maybe older than me, felt discouraged from doing comics when they were at college. But all my tutors, most of my tutors were very encouraging and enjoyed what I did and seemed to think it was an interesting thing to do. But they didn't have any idea of what the world of comics or publishing was about. Of comics publishing, they knew about publishing. But I think I always knew that it was... I wanted to do comics the way I want to do them, so I'd rather make a living doing illustrations and do comics exactly how I want than to have a more commercial bent to my comics work.
Well, I picked up an anthology that you were in a couple of weeks ago called Sentence, which was published a decade ago. And it's interesting looking at it as a sort of a survey of people who are obviously making comics at the time and just thinking how they're doing now. Obviously, you're doing pretty well in terms of doing both comics and illustrations. Gary Northfield, Dave Shelton and Patrice Aggs are doing fine in sort of children's comics, things like The Phoenix and the DFC. And then someone like Matt Abbas is only kind of working in animation now. Malcy Duff is kind of working in galleries. So, you know, 10 years ago, as that kind of formative collective, I guess, that came out of a discussion at a Comica event, did you all sort of compare notes and think, what will we be doing in 10 years' time?
No, we didn't. I suppose apart from Nick Abadzis, who was a bit older than the rest of us, although Dave Shelton was a little older, but basically Nick was the only one at the time who had an established career. So we were all excited about doing that book together and getting our stuff out there. And I'm still in touch with a few of those people, and I'm really happy to see, you know, Gary's cartoons appearing in the Beano or in the Phoenix or whatever. So it's great to see that, but yeah, I don't think we had a conversation at the time about what we'd be doing in 10 years.
Well, it was funny when I looked at the end this year and it said 2002. I was thinking, for some reason I thought this had only just come out because these are quite cutting edge people. It's like Mark Stafford is just beginning to make a name for himself in comics, and it's been a decade. But I guess that just shows, you know, if you're self publishing, it just takes a while to get your work out there.
Yes, yeah, and I suppose all of us, or many of us, were not that far out of college when we did that, and there is that basically just having to make a living doing something, so you can't, and unless you're very, very lucky or very rich, I suppose, just draw comics all the time.
And a couple of projects you worked on soon after then were collaborations with Simone Lear, who I believe you also went to college with. Did it help working on comics with someone else who had just graduated and was keen about a medium that perhaps wasn't quite as supported at art school as it might be?
Well, Simone and I started drawing comics together when we were at college, and we never collaborated on a strip. It was always just the two of us working in tandem on things and encouraging each other. And I definitely think when we published a book together, when we a comic called First together when we were at college, And it definitely helped me, and I think Simon, and possibly many people would feel this, that it's quite nice to be part of a team, especially when you're starting out, having a bit of support and feel like you're doing something together and you're not completely on your own. So that definitely helped, and we haven't done any work together for quite a while. I guess we've maybe both got a bit more confident just doing stuff on our own, and also it's difficult to schedule anything like that. But I'm really happy that, you know, Simon's got a new graphic novel coming out next month. So that's great.
So we shouldn't expect third anytime soon.
Well, we've talked about it occasionally, but no, it's not. There's no plans for that. We've put our... For a while, we were publishing stuff together as Cabin on Press, and that's kind of on hiatus at the moment. It's not definitely finished, but we've both just got too many other things on.
I guess, like a lot of Londoners, I came across your work first in Time Out, in the ongoing narrative, Move to the City.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Did you send your work in unsolicited, or had they come across something that you'd published?
I went to see them with my illustration portfolio, so I was looking for illustration work. But my illustration portfolio always has some of my comics in it, and it had a comic I'd done at college called Guardians of the Kingdom, which the art director liked and asked me if I could turn it into a weekly strip. And I couldn't see how to make that exact story work, but the idea of just taking two characters in a slightly empty environment was something I am interested in. So I just turned that into a weekly thing, and it was a I wasn't that far out of college, and it was really good having a weekly, well, forcing me to do a comic strip every week and paying me every week. So it was a really good thing. Looking back on it, I there's a lot of things about that strip that makes me cringe, but it was a really good experience doing it.
Well, I'd say as a collector of your work, it's a shame that some of it's actually quite hard to get hold of. I believe that a collected edition of that strip is only available in France, which seems quite strange for a comic that's very much, you know, a very British, a very London experience, you know.
Yes, well, that was really just because the publisher, Bulb Comics, Nicholas from Bulb, really pestered me to do it with him, and I gave in. I think at some point it'll get published in English, but it's that thing that all my many self-published things are have all slowly gone out of print, and I wanted to get a new thing done before I started collecting old stuff and republishing it. So the kind of stumbling block of the graphic novel. Now I've done one of those. I feel a little more like I can self-publish or republish or find somebody to republish some old stuff.
So you don't think a strip like Hunter and Painter, because it was serialized, even though it works as a collective narrative, as a book, you wouldn't think of that as a graphic novel?
I suppose it's a bit, it's just because it's short, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't, no, it's not long enough to be a novel, so no.
The concerns of your comics, sort of figures or pairs of figures in fairly desolate landscapes with quite a kind of a bittersweet but humorous tale that they're often involved in. Was that always a theme in your work, or did you just see it something that kept on coming back whenever you did new strips?
Yeah, it is something that just seems to come out. I don't intend that, and I do try, and I don't want to repeat myself, but quite often that happens, and I'm not quite sure why. I suppose I like to, rather than setting my comics in the real world and taking bits of it out to make something manageable, I prefer to sort of start with nothing and build up a little world for it to happen in. And I do like minimal things, so I just put in the least amount of information necessary. And quite often it ends up being two characters in the wilderness.
But it's funny, if you compare something like Hunter and Painter and Goliath, there are a lot of similarities there, that they're both kind of like gentle folk who don't want to be involved in the promotion of killing. And in both cases, it is, I mean, Goliath obviously dies in his most famous moment, and the painter in Hunter and Painter is immortalised, as is shown in the final strip in the collection, by finally painting a violent act. And so it's funny seeing those resonances in your work. I'd like to almost see a Tom Gold collection where it's sort of frustrated gentlefolk through the ages who always kind of come up across the same kind of problems.
Yes. Yeah, no, I can see that. And there's definitely some concerns in there which, in, you know, I don't sit down and think that's what I'll write about, but that's how things tend to turn out. And that was what was quite interesting, I suppose, with Goliath, was having a bit more of a plot and a bit more action in it. Not the Hunter and Painter doesn't have a plot, but having the structure of the Bible story and then putting a character who's like many of my characters in there, kind of, I suppose, for me was a way to make something worthy of being a longer graphic novel-ish, not graphic novella sort of thing.
Well, it's funny, a lot of people talk about when you read a comic, a lot of what you're understanding goes on between the panel borders. It's the story that you make up in your head in between those fragments of time that you see on the page. And with Goliath, you've written a story that takes place in between the lines of the Bible. And so I think those two things go very well hand in hand.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. But yeah, that's definitely what I wanted Goliath to do, was not to contradict the things that actually happen in the Bible, but to weave in between those and be maybe a bit surprising about how it does that.
How did Drawn and Quarterly come about as the publisher?
I've wanted for quite a few years to do a longer book, and I was really having trouble focusing on one project and finding time to squeeze it in amongst illustration work and home life and everything. And I thought maybe having a contract with somebody for a book would really focus my mind. So I wrote to Drawn and Quarterly and sent them some things, and they said, yeah, we'd love to do a book with you. Just do whatever you like and show us when you're done. And Then that didn't really help me focus on it at all. I just put a sort of extra pressure of it being published by this brilliant publisher. So it took me a long time to actually even focus on what story to tell. In fact, that was most of the time, was just me not knowing what to do.
So the original agreement was just to produce a certain number of pages in a certain format?
No, it was just to do a book.
Oh, right, brilliant.
That was all the contract said. And basically, I had... it took me about 4 years to actually get round to starting Goliath. I just had other work to do and had some children and other things like that, and just couldn't focus on it. But finally I managed to get round to doing it, and yeah, and that's when once I found the time to, once I decided that's the story and got started on it, it actually came together not quite quickly, but reasonably well.
But again, it seems odd that you went to an American publisher rather than, say, Jonathan Cape.
Well, this was almost 7 years ago I signed the contract. So there weren't, you know, now there it seems like you've got Nobrow, Blank Slate, Self-Made Hero, all these great British publishers. and maybe I would still go to Drawn and Quarterly now, but at least there would be... Well, there would be choice now. But then, I don't know if they were around, I didn't know of them. So really, the only choice was Jonathan Cape. And at the time, I think Simon was working on Fluffy with them. But apart from that, and Posy Simmons. I hadn't seen that many books of theirs that I didn't know came from a different publisher. And I just thought the lineup at Drawn and Quarterly was amazing, and they make the sort of books that I like to make, and they're beautifully designed and produced, and I just thought that was the place to go.
You've got a very distinctive style that is instantly recognisable as Tom Gold, and that use of cross-hatching, sort of the characters dwarfed by their environment. How long did it take you before you were happy with the style that you thought recognised you beyond, you know, the signature at the bottom saying that it was by you?
Well, That style actually came together quite quickly once I started drawing comics. I was at art school for 4 years in Edinburgh and then 2 years in London. So it was 6 years of drawing and learning to draw. And really it was only in the last year that I started drawing comics. But that was pretty much how I just drew them straight away. And it hasn't massively changed. I've tried to push it forward, and I look at some of the work from early work, and it's there's definitely things that I feel I've improved on since then. But it's just naturally how I like to draw. The cross hatching, I suppose, started because that's how I thought you would how I would do it to be self published. So the fact that it was pure black and pure white meant it photocopied well. But there's something else in it. I like the fact that even though my images might be very minimal and carefully composed and stripped down, having that cross-hatching stops it being completely cold. It adds a sort of bit of a handmade feel and a bit of human warmth. So I think without that, without any of that, or with that bit of wobble of it being hand-drawn, then for me it would feel too cold.
So would that mean you'd never be comfortable making comics just using a tablet, for example?
Well, I'm not sure. At the moment, I wouldn't. I use the computer quite a lot, and I do use it to lay out pages and to tweak my pencil drawings. But then I like to have a pen and ink stage right at the... Or once I've got it right, I like to ink it, and then I can scan it back in and send it off to the publisher. But that handmade time is really, it's kind of important to me. To have it outside the computer sitting in front of me, I really like. But I don't know if maybe some point with the improvement of technology, I might end up working always in the computer. But I still slightly hang on to liking the actual, you know, page.
Your work has been compared to that of people like Edmund Gorey. Was he an influence on you, or were there specific artists that you were fond of when you were developing a style at art school?
Well, definitely Edward Gorey is a big influence. Finding his work, I think, really was a sort of good way into making comics. Because he makes very beautiful books, and I like that, and they aren't... It was nice to see somebody making little interesting objects which weren't photocopied zines and had this slightly more otherworldly feel about them. So that definitely, and the way he cross-hatched, I sort of learned from. And I liked the sort of emphasis on design and on subtlety and quietness in his work. He was definitely an influence, and that was when I was at college. And I suppose everybody of my age will say that Dan Clowes and Chris Ware's work of that time, particularly. I mean, I love both of their work now, but it was more particularly when I was at college. My idea of what good comics were the early Acme Novelty Libraries and 8-Ball. So those two definitely influenced me. And more recently, although still quite a while ago now, I suppose Jason, his work has definitely influenced me, the simplicity and readability of it, I think. I think Goliath is quite influenced by some of his work.
And now there seem to be other artists who have been influenced by you. Are you flattered by being someone who's then influenced a new generation, that perhaps it's part of a chain, you know, you are linked to Gorey and then other people are linked to you?
Yeah, well, it's nice to see, as you say, you know, I've been doing it for about 12 years, making self-publishing and making things, and it's nice seeing the people, you know, people, some of the younger artists working at No Brow, who, you know, people have said that they bought first or second some of our first comics, and yeah, that's really nice, and I think it does feel at the moment like there's a lot of good people coming out, so yeah, that's really nice.
Although it was amusing when I bought the Iron Man at Dave's, they said that you'd illustrated the Iron Man and the Iron Woman, but in fact the person who illustrated The Iron Woman was quite clearly working in your style, to the extent that the people who worked there didn't realise it was by a different artist.
Yeah, that was a bit awkward. I even though I love to do the idea of doing the Iron Man, the actual process of working with Faber at the time was a bit difficult. And I actually did, I was supposed to do the Iron Woman, and I think I even did some thumbnail sketches for it, but we didn't get on that well over the Iron Man, so I ended up not doing the next one. And in a way, I think, looking back, I feel better about those Iron Man illustrations, but I still feel I could have done it better if I kind of wish I had another chance to do that.
Because it's so iconic a book, or
just because I really liked it as a book, and I think looking back, I think I did it quite well, but I kind of wish I'd been able to do something even more to it. And in a way, when I did the gigantic robot, I think that maybe slightly came out of the ideas and things I had around the Iron Man. But it's just that, you know, it's I guess it's what I'm saying about self-publishing and about working with Drawn and Quarterly, is in both of those things I'm kind of free to do whatever I want, and at Drawn and Quarterly it feels like they're just there to support that, whereas that was more of a commercial job with lots of constraints on it. So, you know, you can't have it all, I suppose.
And I suppose in terms of doing illustrations for an existing text, with Goliath you've been a lot more playful, just taking, you know, sort of fragments of what's in the Bible and adding your own narrative that still fits in between with what's there. But obviously with something like the Iron Man, there has to be pages and pages of text before you get to one of your illustrations, just because of the nature of illustrating a book.
Yes, and you have to go with what, for example, in that, I think I had to have an illustration wherever I was told. So it was there were definitely constraints on that, and that can be those constraints can be very interesting. And it was in some ways a good experience doing that, or a good challenge. But it's in a way I like doing it where I'm entirely in control.
And when it comes to doing book covers, do you find that an interesting job, just thinking that there are perhaps 200 pages of text following your illustration? So what you've done has to set the scene, has to be evocative of what's inside, but also be still idiosyncratically you.
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. I mean, I find book covers one of the most difficult illustration jobs to do, because I think somebody spent 5 years writing this novel and I don't want to mess it up in 5 days. So, but on the other hand, you can't completely step away from saying anything in your cover. You have to, as you say, you have to be bold and make something interesting, because it's two things, a book cover, really. It's an advert for the book, which needs to be, in a certain way, brash. But on the other hand, it's also what somebody sees every time they open the book, and you don't want to have a terrible drawing of the main character or something which spoils it. So I always find that it's a difficult job to do a book cover for fiction, but it's on the other hand, it's also a good challenge.
Well, I think it's really interesting the fact that, for example, the Penguin Classics range, where they've got a variety of different comic book creators to do the cover of loads of classic literature, suggests that perhaps traditional publishers think that there are new avenues for traditional literature, that maybe comic book readers, graphic novel readers need a gateway drug, for want of a better word, to get them into reading books that don't have word balloons.
Yes. I mean, I think that Penguin Classics thing is quite a strange... I'm still quite amazed that they...
I think they're lovely, but strange.
Yes, and I'm amazed that they let the art director, whose name slips away now, but I'm amazed they let him get away with it. But it's really fun for that reason. And with something, I did The Three Musketeers, and I did quite a... My first version was much more faithful to the text, and in keeping with it. And they said, no, this isn't what we want. We want something unusual and something about what you think. And that was fun. And with The Three Musketeers, you feel like, well, if somebody wants a classic cloth-bound edition, they can find that somewhere else. And this is just having fun. So I enjoyed that for that reason.
Cool. And now that you've finished Goliath, obviously you're strips are continuing in various periodicals, but hopefully it won't be another 7 years before we see another graphic novel from you.
No, it won't. I've been working on some short little things recently, but I think it's about time to get started on something else. And I feel like with Goliath, I took a lot of wrong turns and lost faith in it at times, and that slowed it all down, and I feel like I've learned quite a lot from that, so hopefully the next book I'll be able to improve on some of the things I did.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right.
For more information about Tom Gould's work, please go to his website www.tomgould.com. And Tom, along with his occasional collaborator Simone Lear, we'll be talking about his work at this month's meeting of Ladies Do Comics at the Rag Factory on Heneage Street off Brick Lane in London on Monday the 23rd of April from 6:30 p.m. Joining Tom and Simone are comic book artists Rachel Ball and Ian Williams. And you can find more information at www.ladiesdocomics.com. That's LadeeZ Do Comics. Tom and Simone will also be appearing a couple of days earlier at the Spring Comica Comiquette, an independent comics fair taking place on Saturday, April the 21st, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Bishopsgate Institute near Liverpool Street Station. Other guests include John Allison, creator of Scary Go Round and Bad Machinery, and Andy Watson, who'll be launching his new Walker Books All Ages graphic novel, Gum Girl. Also at the Comiquette will be dozens of stalls by independent comic creators selling their wares. More info at comicafestival.com. At Orbital Comics near Leicester Square Tube in central London, all this month they're running an exhibition celebrating the re-release of the anthology It's Dark in London. And on display is art by Steve Bell, Jonathan Edwards, Melinda Gebby, Dave McKean, Woodrow Phoenix, and many more. Following the It's Dark in London exhibition, the next display at Orbital will be a collection of work by Roger Langridge, and that opens on the 28th of April, and Roger himself will be in the store from 4 p.m. on that day, signing his work. And that's all taking place at Orbital Comics, 8 Great Newport Street, London, WC2H 7JA. Meanwhile, at Gosh Comics at 1 Berwick Street, London, Simone Lear is launching her new book, Please God, Find Me a Husband, on April the 10th from 6:30 p.m. Following that, the next signing at Gosh is on the 24th of April, where Daryl Cunningham will be signing copies of his new book, Science Tales, and also be in conversation with comedian Robin Ince, and that's from 7 p.m. on the 24th. And Gosh Comics can be found at 1 Berwick Street, London, W1F0DR, with more info at www.goshlondon.com. Today's show and podcasts of all previous episodes of Panel Borders, including interviews with Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Philip Pullman, Audrey Neffenegger, Denise Mina, China Mieville, and many more, can be found on my blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. You can also find more info about Panel Borders by joining our Facebook group or my Twitter feed at Panel Borders. And please do take the time to leave comments and ask questions in any of these locations. Panel Borders was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.